From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Putin on Eastern Ukraine secession vote. Analysts say Kiev's military is not ready to stop a Russian invasion. Hundreds feared dead in a new Nigerian militant attack. Plus, dirty air, a major health hazard. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The United States and NATO say so far there are no indications some 40,000 Russian forces are pulling back from the border with Ukraine, despite claims by the Russian president. VOA's Jeff Seldon is following the story.
Speaking to reporters in Moscow, Russian President Vladimir Putin said he'd urge pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine to postpone a referendum on secession set for Sunday. He also insisted Russian military forces had been withdrawn from the Ukrainian border. Aboard Air Force One, White House spokesman Josh Earnest told reporters a Russian pullback would be a positive step.
We would certainly welcome a meaningful and transparent withdrawal of Russian military forces from the border. That's something that we have sought for quite some time.
But Earnest says there's no evidence to back up Russia's claims. Pentagon spokesman Colonel Steve Warren.
I can tell you that we have seen no change in the Russian force posture along the Ukrainian border.
Warren says if Russian troops were on the move, the U.S. would know. And while some express hopes, U.S. lawmakers are skeptical. The Senate Intelligence Committee's Dan Coats, a Republican, telling VOA, Mr. Putin's actions will speak louder than any words.
If he continues to encourage or support the pro-Russian chaos makers in eastern Ukraine in order to disrupt or influence that election, pulling the troops back would just be a symbol of something that we shouldn't take a whole lot of confidence that this is going to solve the problem.
Stephen Blank at the American Foreign Policy Council says Putin's comments, especially those asking pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine to postpone an independence referendum that's just days away, might be a sign Russia is starting to feel squeezed.
Well, it's a move to take the pressure off because he was told that if there's another referendum, there'll be more sanctions. And these sanctions have begun to hurt.
But Blank says Russia will continue to try to destabilize Ukraine.
As long as Putin is president, they cannot accept a sovereign Ukraine that is inclined to the West.
In the meantime, Ukraine's border guard has already received U.S. shipments of non-lethal equipment, while U.S. aid to the Ukrainian army is still in the works. Jeff Seldon, VOA News, the Pentagon.
Angry pro-Russian protesters in the city of Mariupol in eastern Ukraine blocked police forces on Wednesday from moving at least 14 detained activists from a police station to face a judge as required by the law. About 50 people, relatives of those detained, surrounded a police truck and stopped it from reaching the police station. They claimed that the courts were not in session. This woman named Diana said children, young people were detained here today. Now they want to take them to court. The mothers were acting as a living shield, she said. We don't believe you, is what they said. We've called up on the courts and they did not work today. Mariupol has been the scene of fierce clashes between government troops and pro-Russian activists. This woman who called herself Marina spoke with reporters about the potential of a referendum in order to be a part of Russia. She said, "We want a referendum and to be listened to. We want to express our opinion and live the way we want." Ukrainian forces have launched an offensive to stamp control over the rebel areas and to crush an insurgency that threatens to split the country. With the tensions on the rise in eastern Ukraine, where military and security forces try to regain control of areas held by heavily armed men, including Russians, VOA senior correspondent Andrei Dineshnera takes a look at Ukraine's military.
Western estimates say the Ukrainian Defense Ministry controls between 70,000 to 130,000 men under arms. But Stephen Blank, an expert at the American Foreign Policy Council, says Ukraine's armed forces have enormous problems.
Their command and control at the top has been very shaky. There have been several defense ministers and heads of various forces since the new government came to power. Second, their intelligence services have been penetrated for a long time by Russians. Third, they have been undercapitalized, victimized by corruption and poor leadership for years.
Kerr Giles, head of the Conflict Studies Research Center, says Ukraine has been trying to modernize its armed forces.
It is a great deal less ambitious and less well-funded than the equivalent in Russia. So Ukraine is still operating the kinds of equipment which are no longer in service with the spearhead of the Russian forces. These are older types. They have an older manning system. Much less has changed for the Ukrainian military since the end of the Soviet Union than it has for Russia since the Georgia War.
Experts say Russia's effort to modernize its military was prompted by the poor showing in Moscow's 2008 five-day war with Georgia over two separatist regions. One reform was to make the Russian military more mobile, better geared for rapid response and for local conflicts. The result of those reforms were on display during Russia's annexation last month of Ukraine's Crimean Peninsula. Experts say Ukraine is still tied to having a large Soviet-style army. Giles says another problem facing the Ukrainian military is the potential divided loyalty of its members.
And we shouldn't believe all of the stories that we've seen coming out of eastern Ukraine about defections, but it's still the case that many of the senior levels of the Ukrainian armed forces serve together with their Russian counterparts in the Soviet armed forces. And it's still the case that many of the Ukrainian servicemen that we have encountered in the days before this crisis emerged describe themselves quite openly as being Russian.
Pro-Russian separatists control about a dozen towns and cities in eastern Ukraine. In addition, an estimated 40,000 Russian troops have been deployed on the Ukrainian border, the spearhead of a potential invasion force. Keir Giles and others say the Ukrainian military is not ready to thwart a Russian invasion if it happens.
Certainly in terms of capability, the Russian armed forces are far better equipped and better organized at present than the Ukrainian equivalents. However, there are caveats to that. Now, many of the people who look at the sustainability and logistics of the Russian armed forces still believe that they are no longer in a position to fight an extended campaign, which is, of course, a risk if they overextend themselves into Ukraine. So any operation in Ukraine would have to be as quick or as unopposed as the armed conflict in Georgia or the operation in Crimea.
Experts say if Russia invades eastern Ukraine, it runs the risk of a protracted war, especially if the Ukrainians engaged in guerrilla warfare. And that, say analysts, is not a scenario favored by Moscow. Andre Dineshner of VOA News, Washington.
Still ahead on VOA, the latest on the schoolgirl kidnappings in Nigeria.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its military.
You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
civilians. And sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
All that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
Hundreds of people are feared dead after militants attacked a town in northeastern Nigeria, setting fire to homes and businesses, shooting residents as they tried to escape. Local officials say suspected Boko Haram militants stormed the remote town of Gamboro Ngala on the border with Cameroon. News reports say more than 250 homes, the town's biggest market, and a police station were destroyed. Meanwhile, the U.S. military is providing details about a team of experts heading to Nigeria to help with the search for 276 schoolgirls kidnapped by Boko Haram. Pentagon spokesman Colonel Steve Warren says the team will arrive in a few days.
Their mission there is to simply assess and advise. These personnel will be experts in areas to include communications, logistics, intelligence, all of the functionalities that we believe will be helpful.
Colonel Warren says the United States is not considering a military operation to rescue the girls. Nigeria said Wednesday Britain had also agreed to assist with the search. It said President Goodluck Jonathan asked for and received a commitment from Britain to use its satellite capability and other advanced tracking technologies. World Economic Forum on Africa opened Wednesday in Nigeria's capital amid growing despair over those hundreds of schoolgirls still missing. Analysts say the event highlights Nigeria's increasing duality. It is the biggest economy in Africa, but authorities cannot even keep children safe in their schools. Heather Murdoch is in Abuja with our report.
In 5 years of insurgency, emotions have never been more raw in Nigeria than in the past 3 weeks as the country waits and prays for the rescue of the girls. Protests have grown bolder and the government does not seem to or cannot object. Outside army headquarters on Tuesday evening.
I'm going to ask the mothers in this place, who are these girls to us? I'm going to ask the fathers in this place, who are these girls to us? Let me ask the brothers in this place, who are these girls to us?
Major General Chris Olugolade, the Director of Defense Information, stands by quietly until protest leaders hand him the bullhorn.
Be sure that we listen to you and your protest is understood. Thank you very much.
He promises to meet privately with protest leaders to discuss the rescue of the girls. Boko Haram, an Islamist militant group, claims to be holding the girls as slaves to be sold at the market. The next morning, the city is quiet as the World Economic Forum on Africa opens. Schools, government offices, and many businesses are closed. The roads are mostly empty, but the number of large black SUVs and truckloads of heavily armed soldiers is notable. More than 1,000 business leaders, officials, and heads of state gather in Abuja's posh hotels for the first day of the forum. They discuss not just how to grow African economies, but how to include the regular people in the growth on the world's poorest continent. This is Elizabeth Donnelly, a research fellow at Chatham House, a London-based think tank.
The March news about Nigeria becoming Africa's largest economy, the hosting of the World Economic Forum at the same time that this security situation is evolving, potentially escalating, it really highlights actually the stark contrast that you have in Nigeria. It really is a country of extremes.
Outside the hotels, military men wear flak jackets, aware that this international conference would be an obvious terrorist target, and they would be the obvious victims. Boko Haram has killed thousands of people in 5 years of insurgency, including hundreds of schoolchildren. Last month, nearly 100 people were killed in bombings just outside the capital, and Boko Haram has threatened more attacks in Abuja. Some activists say the security personnel amassed for the forum should be out searching for the girls. This is Candy Nathan at a protest, now known as a hashtag Bring Back Our Girls rally.
Very painful because we have a crisis on ground that we need something to be done about the girls by now.
Other protesters say the economic summit will boost Nigeria's international prominence and its economy, a task that should not stop because of terrorists. Ojonwa Miachi is an activist carrying a sign that says, Bring Back Our Girls, Now and Alive.
I feel that the World Economic Forum, it's the symbol that life can't stop. The country has to run and the country has to go on, but the country has to also find these girls.
Eight more girls were kidnapped Tuesday in northeast Nigeria, a region where three states have been under emergency rule for almost a year. Heather Murdoch for VOA News, Abuja.
Also in the news, South Africans turned out in large numbers on Wednesday to vote in the nation's fifth democratic election. Analysts say the ruling party will likely cruise to an easy win. Despite the growing criticism that has tinged the campaign, voters in Johannesburg said they were proud and thrilled to participate. VOA's Anita Powell went out among some of the polling locations to find out what was on the voters' minds.
Like millions of his fellow South Africans, Zohib Khan woke up early on Wednesday to cast his vote. He and his sister arrived at their Johannesburg polling station before it opened at 7 a.m. and waited for more than an hour. There was just one little problem. Khan still hadn't decided who to vote for.
I have back and forth a lot. I haven't made the final decision yet.
Now, I must note we're standing about 50 meters away from the polling booth.
Running out of time. Yeah. Party I've traditionally voted for has let me down a bit, so I think there's only one other viable option, but I don't like them either, so it's complicated.
Khan, who is a 28-year-old academic researcher, is part of an emerging demographic in this election, which comes 20 years after South Africa ended apartheid and became a democracy. Many South Africans say the party they've long supported, the ruling African National Congress, has failed to address long-standing inequality and provide basic services, and has been hurt by multiple corruption scandals. But many also point to a weak and untested opposition whose political foibles make them difficult to support. Bakan's sister Jahara says she wouldn't let his indecision cut into her excitement to vote for the first time. She is 18 and a member of the so-called Born Free generation, born after 1994.
Yes, very excited. Well, generally, I want to vote for a party that will do the most good in South Africa, because right now I don't think we're in a very good place, so I want to vote for a party that will definitely make a difference.
The usually packed streets of Johannesburg were nearly empty Wednesday. Finding polling stations became very easy. Just follow any car on the road to end up at a polling station thronged with a diverse crowd. At several stations, the mood was jubilant, with voters bringing family members, pets, and children. Some voters donned the rainbow colors of South Africa's flag or wore gear from national sports teams. The ANC is predicted to win with 63% of the vote. For many voters, like 28-year-old Millie Sizwe Notwala, the decision to support the ANC is an emotional one. The ANC was banned under apartheid, and many South Africans suffered for supporting them.
It's a matter of loyalty. I know exactly where I'm coming from, the sacrifice that was paid for where I am today. So I will just go there and do the right thing for my family as well as for my children as well.
Maria Matlalias, 54, has voted in all five elections since she was granted voting rights in 1994. She said she used to support the ANC, but no longer.
I want to change because the other one we was voting for, he's not good for us. Now we have to change to vote another party to get something like water, electricity, better life.
But Gracia Morarora, also 54, says she's giving the ruling party one more chance. She says she's seen few fruits of South Africa's development. She was denied government-subsidized housing and still uses an outdoor toilet in her home just outside Johannesburg.
For 5 years, if nothing changes, if I'm still alive, then I'm not going to vote. I promise I'm not going to vote because it won't help me to vote.
This election perhaps has shown a new facet of the Rainbow Nation, a country not just of different races, as the term originally intended, but of people with wildly differing views who believe their differences should never again force them apart. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
China is a fascinating country
with interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
World Health Organization is warning air pollution is getting worse in many cities around the world, putting the health of millions of people at risk. In the largest study ever done on the state of urban air pollution, data from a survey of 1,600 cities across 91 countries reveal people living in these cities are breathing in dirty air. World Health Organization says this puts millions at risk of serious long-term health problems. WHO Public Health and Environment Director Maria Neira calls this a major public health issue.
The situation we have in front of us tells us that globally, unfortunately, the situation on air pollution is deteriorating, with an exception on high-income countries where the situation is, as expected, improving. But these represent only 12% of the population living in cities.
World Health Organization estimates 3.7 million people under the age of 60 die prematurely from outdoor air pollution in 2012. It says nearly 90% of these deaths occurred in low- and middle-income countries, with the greatest number in the Western Pacific and the Southeast Asian nation regions. Health officials say bad air increases the risk of death from heart attacks, a disease that is, and stroke, as well as respiratory illnesses and cancers. Climate change is threatening human nutrition as well, according to experts who say rising levels of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere are robbing the global population of vital plant nutrients. The conclusion follows the release of the 2014 National Climate Assessment. VOA's Jessica Berman reports.
Unless something is done, climate change will take significant amounts of dietary zinc and iron away from food staples, including rice, wheat, corn, soy, field peas, and sorghum by 2050. Scientists with the Harvard School of Public Health make the prediction in a new study published in the journal Nature. An estimated 2 to 3 billion people receive 70% or more of those essential nutrients from wheat, rice, and legumes, particularly in the developing world. Samuel Myers is a researcher in Harvard's Department of Environmental Health in Boston.
What our study is showing is that, you know, unequivocally, as CO2 concentrations rise up to levels that we expect to see in the next 40 years, there are very significant reductions in nutrients that are really important for public health.
Zinc is essential for a healthy immune system, according to Myers, helping to fend off diarrheal diseases, pneumonia, and measles, while deficiencies in iron cause anemia and decreased IQ in children. Mothers who are severely anemic are at increased risk of death. Some 2 billion people worldwide suffer from zinc and iron deficiencies, resulting in a loss of 63 million life years annually. Life years are a measurement of years that are lost due to disability and disease. For the study, the nutrient content of plants exposed to artificially elevated levels of carbon dioxide was compared to that of plants grown naturally in nearby fields. Data was analyzed from 41 cultivars, or specially bred varieties of grains and legumes, from seven different locations in Japan, Australia, and the United States, where the CO2 experiments were carried out. The results showed significant decreases in zinc and iron in wheat, rice, and legumes at the highest concentrations of carbon dioxide. In some of the plants, researchers also noted decreases in protein stores. As a hedge against rising atmospheric carbon dioxide, Meyer says it may be possible to grow varieties of food crops that are immune to the negative impacts of CO2.
For example, we looked at 18 rice cultivars, and we found that some rice cultivars are much more sensitive to the CO2 effect than others, and that led us to speculate in our paper that conceivably there may be an opportunity to try to develop cultivars of crops that are less sensitive to the CO2 effect.
Ultimately, Myers says the only way to counteract severe depletions in natural sources of zinc and iron is to hold carbon dioxide concentrations steady while developing enriched grain crops or ones that are CO2 resistant. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
And one last item, SpaceX, the first private firm to successfully launch a reusable cargo space capsule, says its booster rocket, known as the Falcon 9, will dramatically lower the cost of launching space vehicles. However, NASA and the French space agency say it may not be a good idea. Speaking at a recent space conference in Paris, officials from NASA and the French agency said their experience in reusing booster rockets shows technical and economic obstacles are simply too costly. In April, SpaceX successfully landed its Falcon 9 booster rocket in the Atlantic, but it was lost due to a strong storm in the region. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us today for International Edition here on the Voice of America. Always good to have you with us. Reminder, you can find us anytime on the Internet at voanews.com. Hope you'll stay with us. The latest world news is coming up shortly. And for our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Zarat Abuzaid, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Thursday.
This is Today in History. On May 8, 1541, Spanish explorer Hernando de Soto became the first European to see the Mississippi River. De Soto headed an expedition that landed on the west coast of Florida in search of gold and silver. On this date in 1846, U.S. troops under the command of American General Zachary Taylor defeated a superior Mexican force in the Battle of Palo Alto, north of the Rio Grande River. Mexico had sought to reassert its authority over the territory that is now a part of the United States. In 1884, former President Harry S. Truman was born. Truman became president when Franklin D. Roosevelt died in 1945. It was Truman who ordered the atomic bombings of two Japanese cities at the end of World War II, witnessed the signing of the UN Charter, and directed U.S. forces to defend South Korea from invading North Korean forces in 1950. In 1886, Georgia pharmacist John Pemberton sold his first Coca-Cola soft drink to the public. At first, the drink was advertised as a valuable brain tonic that could cure headaches, relieve exhaustion, and calm nerves. Today, Coca-Cola is one of the most popular soft drinks in the world. In 1902, the Mount Pelee volcano on the Caribbean island of Martinique began its deadliest eruption, burying the city of Saint-Pierre and killing virtually all of its 28,000 residents. In 1945, May 8th was widely celebrated as VE Day, or Victory in Europe Day. The celebration came a day earlier for British Commonwealth countries and a day later in Russia. It marked the surrender of German forces during World War II. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
It's been nearly 2 years since Libyans went to the polls to elect a new General National Congress. It was Libya's first free national election in six decades, and it did not come easy. In early February 2011, and simultaneously with other regional protests today known as the Arab Spring, Libyans staged a peaceful demonstration against then-Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi. The Gaddafi regime's violent reaction to the protests sparked a full-blown civil war. Soon after, in late February 2011, a collection of former politicians, former military officers, tribal leaders, intellectuals, and businessmen from all over Libya met to form an opposition government that united all factions. On February 27th, they announced that the National Transitional Council would act as the political face of the revolution. The National Transitional Council ruled Libya through 10 months of fighting until, helped by a NATO-enforced no-fly zone, opposition forces finally overcame the last pockets of loyalist resistance and captured or killed the leaders of the Gaddafi government, including Muammar Gaddafi himself. On October 23, 2011, the National Transitional Council officially declared Libya to be liberated. But none of this could have been done had the Libyan people not worked together. Disregarding regional, tribal, and political differences, they united to bring their common enemy to his knees and to open the door to a bright new future for Libya. But unfortunately for Libya and its people, this spirit of cooperation did not last long. The formerly united opposition forces splintered into armed interest groups that demanded greater political power to further narrow agendas. Kidnapping, looting, robbery, revenge killings, intimidation, and extortion have become commonplace in many communities in Libya. Within the General National Congress, tensions between Libyans of different backgrounds and political philosophies have weakened the government and left it unable to provide the Libyan people security or basic services. This is the time when Libya most needs political consensus to move forward its democratic transition, a process that can only advance through peaceful dialogue. The United States urges all Libyans to work together to find common ground to ensure security and good governance for their country so that they can move together toward a bright future.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.